Chapter 11. Sailing. Using the broken limbs of the ancient oak, lashed together with rope-like shreds of bark, I built my raft. Relying only on my second sight, I often misjudged the fit of limbs and the strength of knots. Yet, plank by plank, my raft came together. In its center, I placed a large slab from the hollow of the tree, which provided a slightly cupped seat where I could ride. Finally, I bound the edges with several long strands of kelp that I found among the rocks. By the time I finished, the sun was starting to set. I dragged the meager craft to the edge of the waves. On a whim, before pushing off, I ran back to the tidal pool where the conch shell still drifted. Scooping it up, I dropped it on the sand so that the crab might find its home again. Gulls screeched in laughter, it seemed, as I waded into the cold waves. Before climbing on my feeble vessel, I hesitated. Opposing worlds tugged at me. I stood exactly on the edge of land and sea, of past and future. For a moment, I lost my resolve. Water lapped about my thighs, the same water that had nearly drowned me before. Perhaps I was acting too hastily. Perhaps I should return to shore to think of a better plan. Just then, I noticed a hint of gold shining on the remains of the old tree. The sunset had struck the trunk, etching it in fire. It reminded me of another tree on fire, a tree whose flames still burned me deeply. And I knew I must try to find the answers to my questions. I pulled myself aboard the raft. Settling into the cupped center, I folded my legs in front of me. I looked one more time at the black cliffs, then turned away from shore. Dipping my hands in the chilly water, I paddled for some distance until my arms grew too tired. The fading sun, still strong enough to warm my wet skin, made the water sparkle with many more colors than I could detect. Yet even though I could not truly see, I could sense the web of pink and golden light dancing just beneath the waves. As the tide carried me farther from shore, a breeze leaned against my back. Where the sea might take me, I did not know. All I could do was trust. I thought about ancient seafarers like Bran the Blessed, Odysseus, and Jonah, whose tales I had heard from Branwen. And I wondered whether anyone but Branwen would ever care about my own ocean voyage. I wished that someday I might be able to describe it to her, but in my heart I knew that I would never see her again. A black-headed gull swooped past, skimming the surface of the waves in search of supper. With a loud squawk, it careened toward the raft and settled on one of the strands of kelp, dangling from the side. Clamping its beak on a green frond, it pulled and twisted madly. "Away!" I waved my hands in its face. The last thing I needed at this moment was to have my little craft pulled apart by a hungry bird. The gull dropped the kelp, lifted off with a screech, then circled the raft. A few seconds later, it landed again, this time on my knee. The bird's eye, which seemed as yellow as the sun, examined me, apparently concluding that I looked too large or too tough for a ready meal. The gull cocked its black head and took flight, heading back to shore. As I watched the gull depart, I yawned. The continuous rocking of the waves was making me drowsy, more so because I was spent from my days of trekking from Caer Murthin. Yet how could I sleep? I could fall off the raft, or worse, miss something important. I tried to rest without sleeping. Curling my back, I leaned my head against my knees. To keep myself awake, I concentrated on the slowly setting sun. By now, the great burning globe was resting just above the water, sending a shimmering band of light across the waves, right to my raft. It might have been an avenue of gold, a pathway across the water. I wondered where that path might lead, just as I wondered where my own might lead. Checking over my shoulder, I could tell that I had already drifted some distance from shore. Although the breeze had subsided, I realized that the raft might have caught a current. I bounced over the waves, which splashed me constantly. Despite the jostling, my lashings looked still taut, the wood still sturdy. Licking my lips, I tasted the salty spray. As I laid my head again on my knees, I could not help but yawn again. the sun, swollen and scarlet, ignited the clouds with colors, colors that I could see only subtly. The shape of the sun I could sense more clearly as it grew flatter on the horizon. An instant later, as if it were a bubble that had finally burst, it disappeared below the waves. But I did not notice the onset of darkness, for I had fallen asleep. A sudden splash of cold water woke me. Night had arrived. A host of stars clustered around the thinnest crescent moon I had ever known. I listened to the ceaseless heaving and sucking of the waves, to the bashing of water against wood. I slept no more during that night. Shivering, I drew my legs tightly to my chest. I could only wait for whatever the sea wished to show me. As the sun rose behind me, I discovered that the coast of Goonies had disappeared. Not even the imposing cliffs were visible anymore, only a faint wisp of a cloud stretched like a pennant from what I guessed might be the summit of Iwithfa, though I could not be sure. I spied a timber that had slipped out of its lashing and quickly bound it up again. As the day dragged on, my back and legs grew painfully stiff, but I couldn't stand to stretch them without flipping over. Waves slapped relentlessly against the raft and against me. The hot sun burned the back of my neck. Meanwhile, my mouth and throat felt an even stronger burning, which increased as the day wore on. Never before had I felt so thirsty. Just at sunset, I perceived a group of large, streamlined bodies leaping above the ocean surface. Although 7 or 8 individuals comprised the group, they swam in perfect unity. They moved like a single wave, surging and subsiding. Then, as they passed near my raft, they changed direction and swam a complete circle around me. Once, twice, 3 times they ringed me, leaping in and out of the bubbles of their own wakes. Were they dolphins? Or sea people, perhaps? The ones Bronwyn called people of the Myrrh, who were said to be part human and part fish? I could not see well enough to tell. Yet the glimpse of them filled me with wonder. As they swam away, their bodies gleaming in the golden light, I promised myself that if I should ever live long enough, I would do whatever I could to explore the mysterious depths under the sea. Another night passed, as cold as before. The crescent moon vanished completely, swallowed by the stars. Suddenly, I remembered the constellations and Bronwyn's stories about their origins. After much searching, I managed to find a few, including my favorite, the winged Pegasus. I imagined that the constant rocking of my raft was the galloping, galloping of the steed across the sky. I fell asleep, dreaming that I was carried aloft on the back of some great winged creature, although whether or not it was Pegasus I could not be sure. Suddenly, we were swooping into battle. A darkened castle manned by ghostly sentinels rose up before us. And yes, the castle was spinning, turning on its foundation. It drew us down, down toward its spinning edifice. I tried with all my might to change course, yet I could not. In seconds, we would slam straight into the castle walls. At that point, I woke up. I shivered from more than cold. The dream filled my thoughts deep into the following day, though its meaning continued to elude me. Late that afternoon, the western horizon grew dark. Waves rose to new heights, throwing my vessel this way and that as winds hurled sheets of spray. The raft groaned and creaked. Several strands of kelp burst apart, and a crack appeared in the large slab of wood from the hollow of the old oak. Still, for the most part, the storm passed me by. With twilight, calmer waters returned. I was soaked, to be sure, and terribly thirsty, but both my craft and I remained intact. That night I did my best to repair the broken lashing. Then, as I sat cross-legged, a biting wind smacked my face. Another shadow, darker than before, swept across the stars. Swiftly it covered the southern sky, then the dome above me, until finally the entire sky went black. As darkness swallowed me, my second sight flickered out, useless in such utter blackness. I couldn't see. I was no less blind than I had been on the day I first arrived at the church. Mighty waves began lifting and swirling, tossing my raft around like a mere twig. Water drenched my face, my back, my arms and legs, and this time the storm did not dissipate. Rather, it swelled, gathering strength with each passing minute. Bending low in my seat, I curled up as tight as I could, like a hedgehog fearing for its life. I wrapped my hands around the outermost edges of the raft, clinging to the scraps of wood that were keeping me afloat. My powers! For an instant, I considered calling on them. Perhaps I could bind the raft together or even calm the waves. But no, I had promised. Besides, those powers frightened me deeply, even more than this terrible gale. The truth was, I knew nothing about magic except its terrible consequences, the smell of scorched flesh, the screams of another person, the agony of my own burning eyes. However my powers might have helped me, I knew that I would never use them again. All through the black night the storm howled and raged. Curtains of water fell on me. Enormous waves pounded me. At one point I recalled the story of Bran the Blessed surviving a fierce storm at sea, and it gave me a brief burst of hope that I, too, might survive. Yet this hope was soon drowned in the ocean's onslaught. Both of my hands were numb with the cold, yet I dared not release their grip to try to warm them. More of my lashing popped. One timber split down the middle. My back ached, though not as much as my heart. For something inside me knew that this storm would spell the end of my voyage. The rising sun brightened the sky only a little, but it was enough that I could begin to sense shapes again. My second sight had only barely returned when a powerful wave crashed down so hard that it knocked the breath right out of me. The raft buckled and finally broke apart. In that terrifying instant, I was cast down into the seething sea, battered by the currents. By luck, I touched a floating timber and grasped it. Another wave toppled over me, and another. My strength ebbing, I started to lose my grip. The wild storm continued thrashing and pounding. As the new day dawned, I felt sure that it would be my last. I barely noticed the odd-shaped cloud hovering low over the water, though it looked almost like an island made of mist. With a plaintive cry, I let go. Water poured into my lungs. Part 2. Chapter 12. Fallen Warrior. Not swaying anymore. Not drowning anymore. Once again, I awoke to find myself on an unknown shore. The same sound of surf filled my ears. The same brackish taste soured my mouth. The same feeling of dread twisted my stomach. Were the torments of my years in Goonie just a dream? A terrible, twisted dream? I knew the answer. Even before my sand-crusted fingers touched my scarred cheeks, my useless eyes, and the Galator dangling from my neck, Goonies had been real. As real as the strange, potent smell that spiced the air of this place, wherever this place might be. I rolled onto my side, crunching a shell under my hip. Sitting up, I drank in the air. Sweet as a summer meadow it tasted, but with an edge to it, sharper, truer. While I could hear the waves, sloshing and slapping, not far away, I could not view them with my second sight. That was not because of my poor vision, however. The waves lay hidden behind a rolling wall of mist, mist so thick that it obscured everything beyond. Within the wall of mist, curious shapes seemed to coalesce, hold together for a few seconds, then vanish. I saw something like a great archway with a door swinging closed. As it melted away, it was replaced by a spiked tail big enough for a dragon. Then, as I watched, the tail transformed into an enormous head with a bulbous nose. Like a giant made of mist, it turned slowly toward me, moving its mouth as if to speak, before dissolving into the shifting clouds. Turning my stiff back, I looked around. This beach, unlike the north coast of Gunith, formed a gentle meeting of land and sea. No piles of jagged rocks littered the coast, only shells of pink and white and purple strewn over the fine-grained sand. Next to my foot, a leafy vine crawled across the beach like a shiny green snake. Pink, purple, green! My heart leapt. I could sense colors. Not so well as my memories before the fire, perhaps, but much better than before the sea tore my raft to shreds. But wait, that could not be true. As I examined my own skin and then the folds of my tunic, I knew that they were no more brightly colored than before. With a glance back at the beach, I understood. It was not that I could see any better. It was that this landscape simply radiated color. The shells, the shining leaves, even the sand of this place felt brighter and deeper somehow. If they seemed this vivid with only my second sight, how vivid they would be if I had eyes that could truly see. I picked up one of the spiral-shaped shells. Purple lines wound around its body of gleaming white. It felt comfortable in my hand, like one friend meeting another. I put the shell to my ear, expecting to hear the watery sound within its chambers. Instead, I heard a strange, breathy sound, like the voice of someone far away, whispering to me in a language I could not understand, trying to tell me something. I caught my breath. Lowering the shell, I peered into its chamber. It seemed ordinary enough. I must have just imagined it. Again, I brought it to my ear. The voice again, this time clearer than before. In spite of myself, I thought I heard it say, "Beware! Beware!" Quickly, I put down the shell. My palms felt sweaty, my stomach knotted. I stood up. My legs, arms, and back ached with stiffness. I glanced down at the shell, then shook my head. Seawater in my ears. Maybe that was it. Water. I must find fresh water. If only I could find some to drink, I would feel more alive. I climbed to the ridge of a dune, arching above the beach. What I saw took my breath away. A dense forest, where colorful birds flitted among the spires of towering trees, stretched far to the west. Near the horizon rose waves of misty hills, where the green of the forest deepened into blue. Between here and there, a lush valley unfurled as soft as a carpet. Sunlit streams cascaded out of the woods and over the meadows, merging into a great river that rushed toward the sea. In the distance, more trees grew, though in orderly rows that seemed less wild than the forest, more like an orchard that someone had planted long ago. I was about to descend into the valley and quench my thirst, when something else caught my attention. Although I could see only a little of the eastern bank of the river, it seemed far less green than the other side. Rather, it looked brownish red, the color of dried leaves or rust. At first, it gave me an unsettled feeling, but then I realized that it was probably just some strange sort of vegetation, or perhaps a trick of the light caused by the mass of dark clouds hovering over the eastern horizon. Feeling my parched throat, I turned back to the verdant valley and forest before me. Time for that drink. Then I would investigate this mist-shrouded island, if indeed it was an island. Although I could not quite put my finger on it, something about this place made me want to stay and explore, despite the strange experience with the shell. It might have been the vibrant colors, or it might have been the simple fact that I had trusted in the waves and they had brought me here. Whatever the reason, I would remain for a while, but only for a while. If I did not discover any clues to my past, I would promptly leave. I would build myself another boat, sturdier than the last, and continue my quest. I started down the dune. The sand soon gave way to grasses, their slender stalks bowing in the fragrant breeze. Though still stiff from my voyage, I gathered speed as I descended. Soon I was running across the open field. Feeling the wind in my face, I realized that this was the first time I had run since leaving Caer Murthin. Approaching a stream of bright water, I knelt by the mossy stones along its border. Immediately, I immersed my whole head in it. The cold, clear water slapped my skin, shocking me no less than the colors and smells of this land had first shocked me. I swallowed enough to feel bloated, belched, then swallowed some more. Satisfied at last, I leaned on my elbow, now drinking not the water, but the crisp, spicy air. Grasses tickled my chin. With so much tall grass surrounding me, anyone passing near might have thought me just a brown log by the stream bed. I listened to the subtle rustling of stems rubbing together, the rising and falling of wind in the forest, the steady dancing of the stream. A long-legged beetle, red in hue, crawled lazily across the folds of my tunic. A sudden whoosh of air just above my head jolted me out of my reverie. Whatever it was had flashed past with the speed of an arrow, so fast that I had no idea what it could have been. Cautiously, I lifted myself higher. My second sight detected some movement in the grass downstream. I rose to my feet. A piercing whistle erupted from the grass, followed by hissing and snarling. The angry sounds swelled as I approached. A few steps later, I halted, amazed. The largest rat I had ever seen, as thick as my own thigh, with powerful legs and teeth as sharp as dagger points, wrestled before me. Its adversary was a small hawk with a banded brown tail and gray back. A merlin. Despite the fact that the rat was at least 3 times the bird's size, they appeared evenly matched. Furiously they battled. The merlin's strong talons clung tight to the back of the rat's neck. The rat writhed, trying to bite and claw its enemy's head, bashing the bird against the ground. But the bird's courage outweighed its compact body, for it only screeched and dug its talons deeper, drawing blood from the rat's tough hide. Feathers flew as blood splattered the grass. Clawing, biting, and snarling, they tumbled over each other in a wild frenzy. This fight might have continued for some time with no victor, except that another rat emerged from a thicket by the stream. Whether out of loyalty to its kind, or more likely, desire for some easy prey, it joined in the fray. Clamping its jaws on one of the merlin's wings, it tore at the bird viciously. The merlin shrieked in pain, but somehow held on. The second rat, its face ripped by the bird's beak, released its grip and circled around to the other side. Meanwhile, the merlin's torn wing hung at its side, flapping uselessly, while one of its talons came loose. Sensing victory at hand, the second rat brushed away some feathers caught in its teeth, its legs tensed as it ready to pounce on the weakened bird. At that instant, I ran forward and kicked the second rat in the chest so hard that it rolled into the thicket. Seeing this, the first rat stopped its thrashing, glaring at me with blood-red eyes. With a violent shake, it threw the merlin to the grass. The bird lay on its back, too weak to move. The rat hissed shrilly. I took a step closer. Then I raised my hand as if to strike. The rat, apparently tired of battling for the moment, turned and slipped away through the blades of grass. I stooped to examine the merlin. Although its eyes, 2 dots of black, encircled in yellow, remained barely half open, they watched me intensely. As I reached for the bird, it whistled and lashed out with one of its talons, slashing the skin of my wrist. "What are you doing, fool bird?" I yelped, sucking the bloody wrist. "I'm trying to help you, not hurt you." Again I reached toward the fallen warrior. Again the bird whistled and struck with its talon. "Enough of this!" Shaking my head in dismay, I rose to leave. As I left the spot, I glanced one more time at the merlin. Its eyes had finally closed. It lay there on the grass, shivering. I took a deep breath and returned. Cautiously, I picked up the bird, avoiding the talons in case it suddenly came alive again. I held the warm, feathered body in my hand, wondering that any creature so fierce could also feel so soft. Stroking the injured wing, I could tell that while skin and muscles had been shredded, no bones had been broken. I reached into the satchel that Bronwyn had given me, removed a pinch of the dried herbs, and added to this a few drops of water from the stream. Using the edge of my tunic, I cleaned the gashes made by the teeth of the rat, There were several deep ones, especially along the wing's upper edge. Carefully, I applied the herbs as a poultice. The Merlin stiffened and opened an eye. This time, however, it did not slash at me. Apparently too weak even to whistle, it could only watch me warily. When I had finished, I held the small bird and pondered what to do next. Leave it here by the stream? No, the rats would surely return and finish their work. Take it with me? No, I had no need for a passenger, certainly not one so dangerous. Spotting an oak with wide branches at the edge of the woods, an idea came to me. I put down the bird long enough to pull up some grasses and twist them together into a rough-hewn nest. Gathering both the nest and the bird under my arm, I climbed to a low branch that wore a rich coat of moss. I wedged the nest into place where the branch joined the trunk, then placed the helpless bird within. I looked into the defiant, yellow-rimmed eyes for a moment. Then I climbed down and strode into the forest. Chapter 13. A Bundle of Leaves. As I walked among the spires and the intertwined branches of this ancient forest, an odd sensation crept up on me. It had nothing to do with my second sight, although the light proved dim indeed in these dark groves where only occasional rays reached all the way to the forest floor. It had nothing to do with the resins filling the air, stronger than I had ever smelled, although they brought back the memory of the day I outlasted the storm in the arms of the great pine beneath the Ewythfa. It had nothing to do with the sounds all around me, winds rushing through leaves, branches clacking and creaking, needles crunching underfoot. The odd sensation stemmed from none of these things, or perhaps it came from all these things combined, a sound, a smell, a dimly lit grove, above all, a feeling that something in this forest knew I was there, that something was watching me, that a strange whispering, much like what I had heard in the shell, was now happening all around me. I spotted a knobby stick, nearly as tall as myself, leaning against the trunk of an old cedar. A good staff might help me work my way through the dimly lit groves of this forest. I reached for it. Just as my hand was about to squeeze its middle, where a cluster of twigs protruded, I gasped and pulled back. The stick moved. The twigs, joined by others above and below, began churning like little legs. The knobby shaft bent as it clambered down the cedar's flaky bark, over the roots, and into a patch of ferns. In a few seconds, the stick creature had vanished. So, too, had my desire to find a staff. Then I felt a familiar urge. Climb one of these trees. Not all the way to the top, perhaps, but high enough to gain a view of the upper canopies of branches. Choosing a lanky linden tree whose heart-shaped leaves trembled like the surface of a running river, I started up. My feet and hands found plenty of holds, and I moved swiftly higher. From the distance of 5 times my own height above the ground, the view changed dramatically. Much more light pierced the mesh of limbs, improving my vision. Through the quivering linden leaves, I noticed a round green clump of moss near my head, although, given my experience with the stick, I decided not to touch it. Then, I glimpsed a pair of orange and blue butterflies floating among the branches. A spider, its web pearled with dew, swung freely from a nearby limb. Squirrels with large eyes chattered noisily. A golden-plumed bird moved from branch to branch. Yet one quality from the forest floor did not change. The strange whispering continued. Turning toward the edge of the forest, I could make out the grassy field where I had encountered the Merlin. Just beyond, flowing toward the wall of mist that I knew marked the sea, I spied the sparkling water of the great river. To my surprise, a strange wave lifted from its rapids, a wave that seemed almost like a huge hand. I knew that it could not be so. Yet as the hand of water emerged from the river, dripping water through its broad fingers before plunging back down with a splash, I felt a surge of wonder and fear. Then, from far above me, a huge bundle of leaves broke loose. Rather than falling straight downward, though, it flew outward and across to another tree. Miraculously, the second tree's branches caught the bundle, cradling it in sturdy boughs, before flinging it outward again. Another branch caught it, bent with the weight, then flung it back. The bundle spun through the air, sailing over branches and between trunks, spinning like a dancer. It seemed almost as if the trees of this grove were playing catch with one another, throwing this bundle as children might throw a ball of string. In time, the bundle of leaves dropped lower and lower among the limbs. Finally, it rolled onto the forest floor, coming to rest at last in a bed of brown needles. I gasped. From the bundle, a long, leafy branch suddenly protruded. No, not a branch. An arm, wearing a sleeve of woven vines. Then another arm. One leg, then another. A head, its hair bedecked with shining leaves. Two eyes, as gray as beech bark, with a touch of blue. The leaf-draped figure rose and laughed out loud. The laughter, full and clear, rang through the trees with all the beauty of a bell. I leaned forward on my limb, trying to discern more detail, for I could tell already that this bundle of leaves was, in truth, a girl. Chapter 14. Rhea. Without warning, the limb gave way. I tumbled to the ground, my fall broken by several boughs along the way. My chest smacked hard into one limb, as did my lower back, my shoulder, and both thighs. With a thud, I landed in a cushion of needles. Groaning, I rolled to the side. In addition to the stiffness from my voyage and the usual pain between my shoulder blades, my entire body ached. Slowly, I sat up and found myself face to face with the girl. Her laughter ceased. For a long moment, neither of us moved. Although the light was spare, I could tell that she was about my own age. She watched me, standing as still as one of the trees. But for the touch of blue in her eyes, her garb of woven vines consisted of so much green and brown that she could almost have passed for a tree. Yet the eyes could not be missed. They flashed angrily. She uttered a command in a strange, rustling language, waving her hand as if to brush away a fly. Immediately, the heavy branches of a hemlock wrapped themselves around my middle as well as my arms and legs. The branches held me tightly, and the more I struggled, the harder they squeezed. Swiftly, they lifted me into the air. I hung there, suspended, unable to move.
"Let me down!
Now you will not fall again?"
The girl spoke in my own tongue, the Celtic language I had spoken in Gunith, but with a curious lilting accent. Her expression shifted from wrath to mirth.
"You remind me of a big brown berry, though not a tasty one."
She picked a plump purple berry, growing in the moss by her feet, and put it in her mouth. Puckering, she spat it out again.
"Ech! No sweetness left."
"Let me down!" I roared. I twisted to break free, but the branch around my chest tightened so much that I could hardly breathe.
"Please," I croaked. "I meant no harm."
The girl eyed me severely.
"You broke the law of Druma Wood. No outsiders are allowed here."
"But I didn't know,"
I wheezed.
"Now you do."
She plucked another berry. Evidently it tasted better than the first, because she bent and picked another one.
"Please, let me down!"
Ignoring me completely, the girl went about her berry picking, swallowing them almost as fast as she plucked them. At length she started to leave the glade, not bothering even to glance in my direction.
"Wait!"
She stopped. Looking annoyed, she faced me.
"You remind me of a squirrel who has stolen someone else's nuts and gets caught. Now you want to give them back, but it's too late. I'll come back for you in a day or two, if I remember."
She turned to go, stepping quickly away.
"Wait!"
I gasped. She disappeared behind a curtain of branches. I tried again to wriggle free. The hemlock squeezed tighter, pressing the galator still under my tunic deep into my ribs.
Wait! In the name of the Galator!
The girl's face reappeared. Tentatively, she returned to the grove. She stood beneath the mighty hemlock, looking up at me for some time. Then she flicked her wrist and spoke more rustling words that I could not understand. Instantly, the branches unfurled. I dropped face down onto the ground. Pulling a handful of needles out of my mouth, I struggled to stand. She held her hand up to me. Not wishing to be imprisoned by branches again, I obeyed and did not move.
What do you know about the Galator?
I hesitated, realizing that the Galator must be famous indeed to be known even in this remote land. Cautiously, I revealed as much as I dared. I know what it looks like.
So do I, at least by legend. What else do you know?
Only a little.
Pity,
she said, more to herself than to me. Drawing closer, she peered at me curiously.
Why do your eyes look so far away? They remind me of two stars that are hidden by clouds.
I stiffened. Defensively, I snapped, "My eyes are my eyes." Again, she studied me. Then, without a word, she pressed the last of her purple berries into my hand. Unsure, I sniffed them. Their aroma brought back just how hungry I was, so against my better judgment, I popped one into my mouth. A sudden burst of sweetness struck my tongue. I ate the rest in another swallow. The girl studied me thoughtfully.
I see that you have suffered.
I frowned. She had noticed the scars, as would anyone who looked at my face, and yet it seemed as though she had seen something beneath the surface as well. I felt an inexplicable urge to unburden myself to this strange girl of the woods, yet I resisted. I didn't know her, after all. Only a moment ago she would have abandoned me to the trees. No, I would not be so foolish as to trust her. She rotated her head slightly, listening to some distant whispering of the branches. I noticed the intricate dressing of leaves in her curly brown hair. Although I could not be sure in the dim light of the grove, it appeared that her ears were somewhat triangular in shape, pointed at the top, much like my own. Did that mean that she, like myself, had endured teasing from others for having ears like a demon? Or might everyone in this strange land have pointed ears? Was it possible that this girl and I actually belonged to the same race? I shook myself back to reality. It was just as likely that angels themselves would have pointed ears, or that demons would have lovely white wings. I continued to watch her as she listened. "Do you hear something?" Her gray-blue eyes swiveled back to me.
"Only the words of my friends. They tell me that an outsider is in the forest, but that I already know."
She paused.
"They also tell me, beware. Should I?"
I tensed, recalling the voice of the shell. "A person should always beware, but you need not be frightened of me." She seemed amused.
"Do I look frightened?"
"No," I felt myself grinning as well. "I'm not very scary, I suppose."
"Not very. Your friends you spoke of, are they the trees?"
"They are."
"And you speak with them?"
Once again, the bell-like laughter echoed in the grove.
"Of course, just as I speak with the birds and beasts and rivers."
"And also the shells?"
"Naturally. Everything has its language, you know. You only need to learn how to hear it."
She raised an eyebrow.
"Why do you understand so little?"
"I come from far away."
"So that is why you know nothing of Druma Wood or its ways."
Her brow furrowed.
"Yet you know of the Galator."
"Only a little, as I said before," I added wryly, "although I would have said anything to get those horrible branches off me." The hemlock boughs overhead wavered slightly. The sight made me cringe.
"You know more than a little about the Galator,"
declared the girl confidently.
"One day you will tell me."
She began to walk, somehow certain that I would follow.
"But first, tell me your name."
I stepped carefully over a fallen branch. "Where are we going?"
"To get something to eat, of course."
She bore to the left, following a trail that only she could detect through a patch of hip-deep fern.
Now, will you tell me your name?
Emrys.
She glanced at me in a way that told me she did not quite believe me, but she said nothing.
And what is yours?
She stopped beneath a beech tree, which, though old and twisted, had bark as smooth as a young sapling. Raising a hand toward the graceful boughs, she said,
My friend will answer.
The leaves of the old beech tree stirred in gentle rustling. At first, the sound meant nothing at all to me. I looked at the girl quizzically. Then slowly, I began to hear a particular cadence.
Hurry-ya. Hurry-ya. Hurry-ya.
Your name is Hria?
Again she started walking, passing through a stand of long-needled pines, sturdy and straight.
Rhiannon is my full name, though I don't know why. The trees call me Hria.
Curious, I questioned her. You don't know why? Didn't your parents tell you? She hopped across a slow-moving stream where a plump mallard drifted among the reeds.
I lost my family when I was young, very young. The whole thing reminds me of a fledgling who falls out of the nest before she can fly.
Without turning to me, she added,
It also reminds me of you.
I stopped short, grabbed her by the arm. Seeing some branches bend menacingly lower, I released my grip.
What makes you say such a thing?
She looked straight at me.
You seem lost, that's all.
We strode farther into the forest without speaking, past a red-tailed fox who did not stir from a meal of fresh grouse. The terrain began to slope upward, rising into a steep hill. Yet even as the walking grew more arduous, Hria's pace did not slacken. In fact, it seemed to me that her pace only increased. Puffing hard, I struggled to keep up with her.
You're like Atalanta.
Hria slowed a bit, her expression quizzical.
Who is that?
Atalanta, I panted. A heroine in a Greek legend who could run so fast nobody could catch her until somebody finally tricked her with some golden apples.
I like that. Where did you ever learn such a story?
From someone.
I mopped my brow.
But I wish I had some of those apples right now.
Hria smiled, but did not slow down. As we ascended, enormous boulders, cracked and covered with pink and purple lichens, sprouted like giant mushrooms from the forest floor. The spaces between the trees grew wider, allowing more sunlight through the canopy of branches. More ferns, as well as sprinklings of flowers, crowded around massive roots and tumbled trunks. At one point, Hria paused to wait for me beneath a white-barked tree by a ledge. As I labored to catch up with her, she cupped her hands to her mouth and made a curious hooting sound. An instant later, three small owl faces, flat and feathery with enormous orange eyes, poked out of a hole about halfway up the trunk. The owls watched us intently, then they hooted twice in unison and disappeared back inside the hole. Hria turned to me and smiled. Then she continued to climb the hill. At long last, she reached the crest and halted, hands on her hips, taking in the view. Even before I caught up, I sniffed a new, juicy fragrance in the air. When at last I stood beside her, panting, the sight before me took away what little breath I still had. In the rounded clearing before us, trees of all sizes and shapes and colors twined together, covering the entire top of the hill. Their branches, heavy with fruit, draped almost to the grass. And what fruit! Bright orange spheres, slender green crescents, tightly packed bunches of yellow and blue gleamed amidst the flashing wings of butterflies and bees. Round ones, square ones, hefty ones, wispy ones. Most of the varieties of fruit I had never seen, nor even dreamed of before. But that did not stop my mouth from watering.
My garden!
Announced Hria.
Seconds later, we were devouring whatever fruits we chose. Juices ran down my chin, my neck, my hands, my arms. Seeds stuck to my hair, while half-chewed rinds clung to my tunic. From a distance, I might have passed for a fruit tree myself. The orange spheres exploded with tangy flavor, so I peeled and ate my fill of them before I started trying other kinds. One variety, shaped like an urn, contained so many seeds that I spat it out in disgust. Kriya laughed, as did I. Then I tried another, circular with an open hole in the middle. To my relief, it tasted like sweet milk and bore no seeds at all. Next, I swallowed half of a gray, egg-shaped fruit. Although it had almost no taste, it somehow made me feel sad, aching with longing for all the things my life lacked. When she saw that I had tried that particular kind, Rhea pointed me toward a spiral-shaped fruit, pale purple in color. I took a bite. A flavor like purple sunshine burst in my mouth. Somehow it swept all the aching feelings away. For her part, Rhea swallowed a huge quantity of tiny red berries growing in bundles of 5 or 6 on a stem. I tried one, but it was packed with such overpowering sweetness that it made me nauseous. I had no desire to eat more. I watched in astonishment as Rhea downed them 10 at a time. "How can you eat so many of those?" She ignored me and continued eating. At last, I started to feel full, more than full. I sat down, leaning against one of the thickest trunks in the garden. Afternoon light sifted through the leaves and fruit as a gentle breeze flowed over the hill. I watched as Rhea eventually reached her limit of the sweet red berries. She joined me by the trunk, her shoulder nudging my own. She opened her arms to the wondrous array of trees around us.
"All this," she said gratefully, "from a single seed."
My eyes widened. "A single seed? You can't mean that."
"Oh, yes. The seed of the Shimura tree yields not just one tree, but many. Not just one fruit, but hundreds. And though the Shimura yields so much, it is so difficult to find that its scarceness is legendary. As rare as a Shimura, the old saying goes. In all the Druma, there is but this one."
I drank deeply of the scented air of this clearing. "This is not my home, yet I feel I could stay here long and gladly."
"Where, then, is your home?"
I sighed. "I don't know."
"So you are searching for that?"
"That and more." Rhea twirled a vine from her sleeve.
"Isn't your home wherever you are?"
"You aren't serious," I scoffed. "Home is the place you come from, the place where your parents live, where your past is hidden."
"Hidden? What in the world do you mean by that?"
"I have no memory of my past." Although she seemed intrigued, Rhea asked no more questions. Instead, she reached for another cluster of red berries and popped them in her mouth. Through this mouthful, she said,
"Perhaps what you are seeking is nearer than you know."
"I doubt it." I stretched my arms and shoulders. "I will explore some more of this place, but if I can't learn anything about my past, I will build a new boat and sail as far as I must, to the very horizon, if that's what it takes."
"Then you won't be long here, I suppose."
"Probably not. Where is here, anyway? Does this place have a name?"
"It has."
"What is it?" Her expression darkened.
"This place, this island, is called Finkaira."